Jim Joyce! Where are you, man? Where's Jim Joyce?
I am so sorry to say that Jim Joyce is not joining me today. As you guys have noticed, we've skipped a couple of weeks. I think between both of us traveling and just lots going on. So unfortunately, Jim can't make it. And this is actually kind of crazy. So I'm doing this, just having a guest on who is actually waiting in the waiting room already. But I wanted to kind of kick us off. I can't believe I'm kicking off season 14. That's right. We went from 12 to 14. You know, not superstitious or anything, but why have a season 13? So kicking off season 14, missing Jim Joyce here. Maybe before we sort of dive in and have the guest in, I just want to make a quick couple of comments. I know just in the last couple of weeks, you know, between for Paratherapeutics, you know, initially the announcement, and for those who listen to my DTX podcast, we released a special episode a couple of weeks ago, and then we saw Chapter 11 filing. You know, while there's a lot of naysayers that are coming out, I think there's certainly lots of lessons learned, and I just want to kind of give a big kudos to Corey and team for spearheading what they spearheaded. And there's many other trailblazers that are learning on the heels. And I think, you know, the future of digital therapeutics or self-paced digital tools are here and here to stay. That's kind of the short version before we dive in. Lastly, before I let the guest in, I want to say that for these cases where either myself or Jim are not available, feel free to apply. Just jump, you know, for Jim's spot, for example, we're definitely looking for American Irish. Notice not Irish American, but American Irish, and a funny person. So if anybody wants to be Jim's stunt double for this, please inquire. On this note, I'm gonna let Deborah into our chat here. And let me just make sure. Hello, Deborah.
Hello, Eugene. How are you?
Doing well. You know, thanks for joining me here. And this feels really odd because this is the first episode in over 120 episodes that I don't have Jim Joyce with me. It saddens me, but I'm gonna
It's
take
me
all of
too.
your energy and all of your you know, fun. I know we just met briefly, literally just what, 2 months ago through wonderful Ann Mon
Yes.
Johnson. So looking forward to getting to know you more here and for our audience. Would love for you to give us a little bit of background. Usually both Jim and I interrupt and be rude about it, but I'm just gonna have to be rude by myself. So here we are.
Terrific. Well, I think I've watched a couple of your episodes. You guys do a great job. I think we should start the way you always start. Like you and I should welcome Jim, right? We should say, Jim Joyce.
So I actually, before I let you in, I actually did that. And then I kind of like, you know, well, there was nobody to respond. But you know what? Hold on. I want to say, Deborah!
Eugene, great to see you.
Great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really a treat to be here. I loved getting to know you at the American Telemedicine Association. I mentioned then, and I'll share with all your viewers that you are just a very talented moderator. You know, you just take what is sometimes a boring back and forth, and people in the audience are thinking, is anybody ever really going to discuss the important issues? And you got right to them in a way which gave people space to say how they really felt.
Thank you.
So for that, thank
Listen,
you.
you know, I enjoy it. B, you know, it's always tough to be on the other side in the positions where, you know, there's non-disclosures, there's, you know,
Yes.
rules, the comms people try to pre-write it. I've been there. You know, the comms people never, well, I'll pause there. But anyway, thank you for that feedback. So.
You are welcome. You are welcome. So, I know you like to start with a little bit of personal background, and
Yeah.
it was fascinating to just prep for this and think about, okay, what's relevant, what's meaningful. We don't really tell the early part of our stories very often, right? And so I kind of work backwards from where I think we're going. So I was the oldest of three children of, you know, each of my parents were first generation college. And so in many ways, they didn't know what they didn't know, and they figured it out together. And I was raised on, you know, with very, very few resources, family, camping, vacations, et cetera. But my father, who graduated as an engineer, hated engineering, and then went back to school when I was a baby to become a lawyer at night. So my parents had very little, was always very active in the community, whether it was philanthropy, raising money for it, even though he didn't have very much, or supporting political candidates that he thought were important. And I was always far more intrigued with his world than the world of my stay-at-home mother, even though I loved her very much. And by the time I was a teenager, my mother had long tired of going to all these fundraising dinners where she felt like it was the same thing again and again and again. And I thought it was pretty exciting. And so I went with my father and I just listened and watched and observed how decisions got made, who influenced who, how money got raised, you know, where the power was in the room. And it was a great window for, you know, what would help me later on in my career. And I think I inadvertently, and the women of my generation sort of without raising their hand, kind of became these pioneers, which we never set out to do. But I knew from an early age that I wanted to work. I might eventually want to be in the home and raise kids, but I wanted a career. And at that time, you know, television shows weren't a lot about different careers. They were about other things. And so you basically knew the careers your parents had and their friends had. And so for me, you know, the women around us were either teachers or nurses. And the only two women who were not doing that that I knew about were Mary Tyler Moore, who was a newscaster on TV, and Bella Abzug with her big hats, who was a very loud congressperson from New York. And I thought, well, given those two choices, I don't think I have the talent to be on TV, but I'd love to have a big impact on something and make the world a better place. You know, politics could be interesting. And when I was a senior in high school, my history teacher, it was the year of a Democratic convention, decided that all the history classes would become state delegations and we, whoever wanted to, could apply to become a candidate and experience what it was like to run for president and go around and make speeches to different state delegations, et cetera. And long story short, I was Scoop Jackson and I won. And so that was sort of my first,
beginning of a political career.
Beginning of a, which never happened, but at least it was maybe a prelude to the world of government. I went to Haverford College and was at a time when they had just gone co-ed. So I was one of 18 women in a school of about 1,200. And, you know, again,
you said 18.
18.
Wow.
You know, it was not intentional because when I, Haverford is a, was a brother sister school with Bryn Mawr. And when I went to visit, it looked co-ed. Like I said, oh, they're going, you know, this is all about name only that they're separate. And it wasn't until I got there for orientation and I realized, no, it's not name only. You're really only one of 18. And so in that environment, particularly in a school where it's a Quaker school, so decisions are made by consensus, you learn how to lead in different ways and you learn what it means to be a minority. And you learn to think of yourself as female for the first time, like going through life that way, you know, and great preparation for boardrooms and corporate meetings where I was, again, the only woman. Fast forward, after Haverford, I went to Columbia Business School and then had a career early, had early exposure to the world of data and information by going to Dun & Bradstreet right after business school. They had a program where they hired four MBAs a year who reported to the CFO and then rotated around the company. And then fast forward, went from Dun & Bradstreet to Warburg Pincus to a Welsh Carson venture capital portfolio company where we built a competitor to IMS Health. And then I was launched into healthcare and I felt like I found my people. They were mission driven around saving the world. And, you know, and I was very happy and worked at Weill Cornell, worked at many different places in healthcare, but found I really loved the intersection between strategy and execution. How do you have a vision for where the world is going in a meaningful way? And then how do you make that happen? And how do you mobilize other people to care about that vision? And how do you refine it as others become part of that coalition? And I took in January of 2018, because I know you would like me to also talk more, a little bit more about the VA, I took all of those experiences and went to the VA to lead the Secretary Center for Strategic Partnerships and moved myself to Washington. So why don't I stop there? I haven't given you much of a chance to be interrupt.
No. I'm honestly like, I'm taking it all in. I mean, just fascinating journey, first of all. I did want to actually rudely interrupt. I like your comment about strategy and execution, because especially in a startup world, right? Strategies are great, but it's de-risking, like literally sometimes daily, is a key component. And so I'm actually kind of curious on your experiences through your career on great ways to actually execute on the strategy and make it as tactical as possible, because there are many strategy teams that sit in larger corporations in an ivory tower. It's really just coming up with slides and right? There's lots of good research that's done. But until you start de-risking it out in the front lines, nothing really happens, right?
So exactly. And I've had some of I've been part of some of those departments. So look, I think particularly for startups, it's really critical to define what success looks like and how you would measure it, right? How do we know that we got there? Where are we going? Once we get there, here's what it looks like. Here's what's in place. Here's how we're going to measure it. Once you have that, you then work backwards. Okay, what do I need to get there? Who needs to be involved? What are we missing? What could go wrong? Because it's, you know, you set out a path, but things could change. And I think you have to be relentless about the implementation and execution. And also, in order to do that effectively, figure out who is critical and can you get them to care about us, right? Can it, because in a perfect world, if you can get everyone to care about where you're going, they will execute so much better than any checklist, any job description that you could define for them, because they own it. They live in that space. They know what great looks like. And in many cases, they've been waiting for someone to come along and give them the freedom to actually make it happen the right way, you know?
No, listen, absolutely. And, you know, I do want to sort of transition, because to me, the VA is just a, you know, I've never been kind of inside the VA as far as any projects or anything else. I find it the most fascinating organization. I mean, I want to say between 5 to 10% of the whole U.S. population, I don't know, to be honest, with the latest stats are covered.
About 9 million veterans.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yes.
And I also know that they're actually very progressive, you know, in what they do. I mean, just as an example, I know they've were early adopters of health coaching, right? I know a lot of the new technologies that are out there, they're early adopters and testers, right, to just help, you know, veterans as much as, you know, anybody can. But I'll pause here. I think, you know, at least many people that I speak to don't think of VA as an innovative you know, organization, because it's part of the government and all of this stuff. So curious on your combination of observations, and I think you were doing some ecosystem partnership stuff there. Yes. I'll pause.
So I think I was, you could lump me together with most of the people you talked to before I went to government. I thought, okay, motor vehicle, you know, what the IRS, what else do we know about our government? And I came with my 100-day plan, right, as we all do, about all the things I was going to work on. And the truth is that people in government are very mission driven. That's why they're there. They're not waiting for people from the private sector to show up and tell them how to get things done. They're sometimes open to hearing about it, often open to hearing about it, but in many cases resent the idea that they're not, and that there's a perception that they're not innovative, and justifiably. So, you know, the VA is the nation's largest integrated healthcare system. 9 million veterans, 60 million annual patient appointments. I mean, the scale is just enormous. 170 hospitals, 1,070 clinics. So just national scale, right? And the way the VA is structured, because they take care of veterans from the time they leave this active duty till the time they leave this earth, they are driven by prevention and outcomes, right? Very different from how the rest of our commercial healthcare system works. And so every day, these people are getting up thinking about how do they have the biggest impact on the quality of life of veterans? And so therefore, the VA has been a hotbed of innovation. They were the first to create the electronic medical record, a system called VISTA, way before COVID. Yeah. And we can talk about this. They were leading the nation in telehealth. They were the first ones to do research in prostate cancer to create the PSA test. They've done innovative work around Hep C. And so, and they did the first heart transplant. They've done innovative work around liver disease. So I think no matter what it is, you know, there are people in the VA who are leading that effort. Now, when I got there, again, it was a situation where there was so much I didn't know. I didn't even know what to ask for. The role that that I was hired for was to lead the Secretary Center for Public-Private Partnerships. I didn't know enough to ask whether I would have contracting authority in that office, because my whole life, all you're doing is buying and selling, right? You're spending money or you're being given money. There's no such thing as no authority to do that, right?
Right.
But in government, there is. In government, there is. So I get there and pretty early on realize that I have no authority to pay an outside organization for anything. So I become like the endowment office of Harvard or Yale or pick your favorite university. And I have to go out and ask private sector companies to either provide services free to veterans or make a donation to the VA, an agency that has, you know, the second largest budget government. So how was I going to do that? And it took a while to figure out the right place to focus. And it took a while to figure out also how to get things done in government, a very different environment than what I had come from. And what I quickly realized was, A, you can't come with a, like any other job, but you can't come with a long list of 12 things you want to get done. Pick two or three very important, impactful, meaningful initiatives and focus on those. And then in order for the private sector to be interested, my strategy was focus on innovation. Focus on what can get done at the VA that can't get done anywhere else because of this focus on prevention and outcomes, and because the VA was piloting and implementing so many innovative initiatives. So one of the areas I focused on, the secretary said access was one of his priorities, healthcare access. We have 9 million veterans, 3 million of them live in rural communities, either far from a VA medical center geographically, or even though the VA had telehealth already, insufficient broadbands in their their home to have a video telehealth session. So one of the areas I decided we would focus on was building partnerships around access and telehealth. At the time, before COVID, the VA was already doing 2,000 telehealth visits a day, and in 2016 had done a pilot with iPads and veterans to see what would happen if they discharged patients to go home with an iPad and have telehealth, as opposed to having to come back to the medical center. And they found much greater rates of patient satisfaction, of compliance, of showing up, of making their appointments as opposed to no-show appointments, reduced cost, and it was a huge success. So we started to think about how can we help? So we focused on two areas. One was veterans who don't have sufficient broadband access in their home. And we started to think about, rather than building new VA medical centers and all of the yep. taxpayer resources and the time that would take, we started to think about who else was already in rural America with broadband. And we started to think about schools and libraries, but you know, those places are kind of one-off.
Taken.
You have to negotiate with each town.
Right.
So then we thought about Walmart. And when we looked at where Walmart had locations and where VA had locations and where veterans were far from a medical center, you know, the whole world lights up when you put Walmart stores on a map.
Yeah.
90% of Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart. And so, you know, I started calling around Walmart, making my pitch to different people. And finally, I got to somebody who I said, you know, in places where it makes sense to you and to us, would you donate a private room where veterans could come in to the store and piggyback off of your broadband to have a video telehealth session with their VA provider? And I said, you know, it makes sense for all these reasons. They're your customers. They've served their country. They'll probably buy milk when they're in there. And they said, yes, 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 that all makes sense. And we're going to do this. But you probably don't know that we believe telehealth is important for our employees who are often working two mm-hmm. jobs and don't have time to take off work to go have a telehealth, have a sit in a doctor's office for a medical appointment. And we believe the same thing is true about our customers. And we have had two failed telehealth pilots. And because the VA leads the nation in telehealth, we want to learn from you. So then I knew I had a win-win partnership. I had the priority of the secretary. I had the priority of senior leadership at Walmart. We both wanted the same thing to happen. We had complementary assets to bring to this party. And we had buy-in at senior levels from both sides. And we had an innovation story that they could tell again and again, right?
And a need from, let's call it us health consumers, right? Both, you know, Walmart customers, but also the VA veterans, right?
Yes.
So, you know, people. So there's a dire need to get online, to get into that room, right? For lack of a better term. So
right. And veterans, awesome. You know, we said, imagine if veterans could, instead of a Walmart, in addition to a Walmart store being within 10 miles of every American, what if a VA healthcare access point was within 10 miles of every veteran? You know,
mm-hmm.
how to bring these services to these people who you know, did so much for our country and deserve easier access to healthcare. So that was one partnership we built. The other was we thought about the veteran population that has broadband in their house, but can't afford the unlimited data plan that is required to have these video sessions. So we went to the carriers and we said, we would like you to zero rate the VA Video Connect app for veterans and caregivers, which means that you have to have the minimal data plan. But as long as you have a data plan, there'll be no charges against your data for the sessions that veterans would have VA caregivers. And so those two partnerships, we did others in precision oncology and suicide prevention, but I think those two really made a difference in telehealth. And then in oncology, we did a partnership with the Prostate Cancer Foundation and Sanford Health and IBM and Bristol Myers Squibb, and we stood up centers of excellence around precision oncology, first prostate and then breast. But one of the things we said was, while these centers of excellence are going up, we can't wait to serve people in rural communities. They need access to precision medicine also. And so we got a grant from Bristol Myers Squibb before COVID in 2019 to launch tele-oncology services. And there's now 30 communities within the VA that access tele-oncology for their patients and another 30 waiting to get onboarded. So it's just been hugely successful. Yes.
And would you say one of the key, because I mean, in Europe, there's quite a lot of PPPs, right? It's less heard of in US typically, right? Just maybe it's just not, it's done. Would you say one of the key sort of components of it be of it working is the win-win? I mean, some of these things that you discussed, I mean, there's no kind of forcing hand. There's, on one side, of course, the for-profit entity needs to make the profit, right? How would you describe, like, what's the kind of the success sauce, right, to these partnerships?
And I'm glad you asked that because I'm in the process of writing some articles with some of our partners about, what we did, because I think the people who work at the VA deserve a lot of credit for making these novel programs successful. I do think it has to be a shared strategic priority. And then after that, all of the priorities that you would put around successful execution in the private sector have to be in place. But I think actually public-private partnerships are America's secret weapon. I think the private sector is the ro most robust there is in the world in terms of innovation, urgency, expertise, assets. And our US government is mission-driven and has scale. And if you bring those two groups together around whether it's healthcare, education, defense, how do we remain competitive, immigration, the supply chain, very powerful, innovative solutions will come as a result.
Fantastic. I want to cover maybe two more key topics real quick. So one, I noticed you also spent time Fitzroy, which I'd never actually heard of until I kind of reviewed, where you were looking at, spinning up or spinning out companies. And I know you're doing some work or advising Redesign Health. I always, and I, back in my pharma days, we also had a venture building unit. The way, I always looked at it is that a venture building unit for a large organization is typically a de-risking mechanism, and you need, entrepreneurs on the ground finding, let's call it the problem statement, the market fit, being incentivized. So I'm actually curious always to hear the entrepreneurs that started from their need or discovering that need versus a company or an entity saying, well, we're going to do some research, we're finding this, let's bring a bunch of hired guns in. What are your thoughts on this? On all our, I mean, you have to be entrepreneurial enough to come into, Redesign Health or any of these spin-ups anyway. Just curious
Yes.
on what you've seen.
Yeah, so I think large organizations have understandably struggled for a long time to prioritize and make sense of all the innovation and all the solutions that people are bringing them. And so they've experimented with different ways of making decisions and making these selections. Sometimes they have their own innovation unit, sometimes they join an innovation ecosystem like plug and play, or they are a sponsor for an incubation that focuses on certain kinds of solutions. I think both sides have to be sensitive to the organization and its needs and what it means to implement solutions. One of the pluses of spinning out a solution that already exists at a large organization is that it's proven that it already exists at a large organization and is successful. And to the extent that you can find other large organizations that look like that, then you've got a winner, right? And that's the philosophy of Fitzroy. Redesign is again approaching it differently. They're saying there are solutions that don't exist. There are
White
areas where
spaces.
people are looking for a solution. How do we stand up a company around that? And hopefully, I think Redesign and others have evolved to the point where some of their funders are the potential clients for these solutions, which is one of the things we did early on when I was at Walsh International building a competitor to IMS Health. The pharma companies were our investors saying, okay, this is what we want you to build, right? If they're saying that, they're going to buy it when it's created. So that's a de-risker, obviously.
No, listen, absolutely. We just actually spent a little time with Missy Krasner and a few others from InDesign. I love the team. I love some of the spin-ups that's been happening out there. So and many of them include health coaching, so which is always great to hear for us.
It all comes back to health coaching.
Listen, whether it's health coaching, I think at the end of the day, and I keep saying this more and more, technology is fantastic. It's a huge, huge, huge enabler. It's it can level us all up. At the end of the day, at some point in our life, we need an actual human being to lean on, right? And it can be in the form of a health coach, a clinician, a nurse, et cetera. So it's just there. As we started with where we met at the ATA and kind of the broader, let's call it digital health. To be honest, I don't even know how to define it these days anymore. Digital health, right? I mean, everything's technology now, or pretty much everything is digital. Your thoughts on telemedicine or telehealth, and maybe even broader digital health?
Yeah, so I think it's a very patient-centered. Way of delivering healthcare. And so in my mind, I think it's here to stay. I think patients want it, and I think they're voting for it. And I think technology is only going to make that experience richer. There's going to be more data that can be transmitted. There's going to be more precise cameras that can take pictures of what's on our skin or, what's in our throat.
Yeah.
I just think we're at the beginning of a very, very exciting time.
Listen, I absolutely agree. And I'm still kind of saying the whole calorie intake versus burn. I'm willing to swallow something that sits in my esophagus or in my intestine to watch what it processes and give me pointers. But anyway, that's been my dream for, so if anybody watching and listening knows any technologies out there. So we're coming to the part where usually, I kind of just sit back and Jim, comes up with this, crazy story, but I'm going to do my best to emulate Jim. And I'm actually going to go back. So you are walking in to a local community center where you're going to present. And yes, it's an event to raise some money for a great cause, right? And there runs up to you afterwards, a young woman that's saying, "Oh my God, you're Deborah Scher. I've been kind of following you. I've been, watching you from afar. You've done some amazing things, specifically around, in the VA and kind of transition from government to, personal. Any advice that you would give me? How would I proceed as, in my life?"
Well, it's a broad question, Eugene. Yeah, I think try to stay true to what you're trying to accomplish. If you have a mission and a vision, even if it's unpopular, even if it seems overwhelming, stay true to it and don't feel like you need to have all the answers yourself. I think it's different now. There's a lot of focus on teamwork and groups. And I think that's much healthier than growing up thinking you have to have all the answers. Learn from others, surround yourself with people who are smart and who support each other, and be relentless. Don't give up. Just constantly be relentless and create that combination of strategy and execution so that you can take a vision and actually make it happen and change the world.
Love it. Deborah, thank you for making the time. You and I think we did great. Let's see, Jim will, I'm sure, comment and judge us a little bit. And to all the listeners and followers, share, subscribe, and please comment.
Thanks so much. Such a joy to spend this time with you, Eugene. My best to Jim.
Take care.